Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you two, Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight, since the lack of brother Jay, we're going to talk about horror movies. Two of them.
Yeah, we are.
To be specific, 1968's Night of the Living Dead. And 2017's Revenge, almost 50 years apart, and nothing really connects these movies together, so it's kind of an odd pairing, but a pairing we'll go with.
Yeah, well, a little peek behind the curtain. You really wanted to talk about Night of the Living Dead. I really wanted to talk about Revenge.
Yeah, so compromise.
We are accommodating each other.
Okay. So, we can probably Kubo Night of the Living Dead, frankly. It's, you know, it's an iconic movie. It's arguably what interpreted the modern concept of what a zombie is.
Yes.
I mean, they're not even called zombies, but before this movie, zombies were pretty much like the Caribbean variety. Now we get zombies with no voodoo. There's a couple reasons I love this movie. First of all, they did so much with so little as far as like budget and acting.
Yes.
And the, well, we'll get into it.
Oh, also, side note, speaking of doing a lot with very little, I also watched Murder Party this week.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. And did you like it?
Okay. Yeah, actually I did. More than I thought I would.
That's was it Jeremy Saulnier?
Yes.
On my list. Can't wait. I realize this is already tangenting away, but I've been watching punk rock documentaries. I watched two about the Runaways, and then one called Who Killed Nancy?
Of course.
And it's great. It's all interviews with all the people that were involved with Sid and Nancy in the day. And it doesn't break any new ground, but it just confirmed my belief that while the concept of the Sex Pistols was really, really crazy and fun in that, you know, in the whole anarchy sense of it, I wouldn't want to hang out with any of those people. They were all monsters.
Yeah. They seem terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Like really horrible people.
Yeah. Even when I was young enough to really dig the music, they still seemed like garbage people.
Yeah. Well, I want to get a copy of Nevermind the Bollocks, but I don't think it's available. No, it's not. I'm sorry. The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, but I don't think it's available on DVD. That was the Malcolm McLaren sort of documentary about the Sex Pistols, about how they had three record labels, paid them to record albums, and only had to record one because they kept getting fired but get to keep the money.
Was that a strategy?
I don't think so as much as just happened to be the case. I don't think there's a lot of strategy. Anyway, so we'll talk about Sex Pistols later at a different time. Right now, let's talk about 1968's Night of the Living Dead. So I'm sure you saw it with me the first time at some point. But do you have fond memories of the movie?
Yeah. I mean, I watched it when I was really little. And it's the type of horror movie where it's not... there's a lot of suggested, like, graphic content, but there's not really a lot of graphic content, so it's relatively suitable for a younger kid to watch. But still, like, really full of tension and dread and a good horror movie. And the ending, The ending is great. The ending really set me up for a lifetime of appreciating the unhappy ending.
Yeah, this is the bleakest ending in movie history, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there are bleaker endings, but you could say they are all either aping or paying homage to this one, right?
Maybe. Like, well,
the one that comes to mind the most is The Mist.
Yeah.
The Mist is a pretty The Mist brutal is ending.
Super dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. An ending that, of course, Stephen King didn't write, but he said he would have if, you know.
If he could write good endings?
Yeah, exactly. Or hadn't been high on cocaine and missed that, or drunk and missed that part of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lots of respect for Mr. King. Lots of respect. But when we talk about the movie Maximum Overdrive in a couple weeks, we'll talk about a movie that he directed that he doesn't remember directing.
Nice.
Pretty much. I think the movie, the ending of this movie is really bleak, considering I don't think it sets you up for this ending.
No.
I mean, the movie is, it's got some peril, but it's pretty light in tone. It's kind of ushering you along on a normal kind of story. It's just a siege movie with ghouls outside.
Yeah, but the stakes, even though it's life or death, the stakes are pretty low for what you'd expect out of a zombie movie. You know, as the zombie genre grew, it became all about the inevitable overwhelming force, right? And so there's always, even in moments of calm, there's always an existential dread at the boundary of everything. Because, you know, just with being familiar with the genre, that there's going to be a massive horde of these things at some point. And that's not really present in this movie.
No, there are no rules.
Right.
Every movie after this, you have to presume that the characters know the rules. Because you know that the writers know the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I mean, they try to build some rules with the radio and TV broadcast, which I thought were really clever. It just captures that whole kind of, we don't know what's going on, but we're going to report it live. Back in those quaint yeah. journalism days.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so plot.
Yeah.
Okay.
This movie has a fantastic opening.
Oh, it does. We have bickering siblings, Johnny, played by Russell Strainer, who, by the way, he co-wrote Return of the Living Dead with John Russo and Rudy Ricci.
Oh.
Yeah, he was like George Romero's partner. Maybe they were students at the same time or something. Go to a real Night of the Living Dead documentary podcast or whatever, because this is not that. But I'm sure there's lots of lore, lots of interviews with these folks. Especially since they sort of got screwed in the copyright. The movie changed titles, and when they changed titles, the new title company didn't put the copyright notice on Night of the Living Dead, so that went into the public domain. Which is why you can find it in every single collection anywhere.
Oh, I was not aware of that.
Yeah. Theoretically, I mean, this movie has made like hundreds of millions of dollars. But not for George Romero. And a lot of these movies were like, the distributorships were sort of mob run. Like, you would literally take your movie from theater to theater. Like, take the cans of movies to the theater owner to say, hey, show my movie. But if you had connections, you know, whatever. Anyway. It's kind of how the early porn industry was with pornographic movies. All mob distributed, all mob run. Fascinating stuff. Eric Schlosser, the author of Fast Food Nation, wrote a book after Fast Food Nation. I forget what it's called, but a third of it is about the pornography, the beginnings of pornography and the mass marketing of pornography, like from the 60s, mainly through the 70s. And it's fascinating how...
What are the other two-thirds about?
There's one about marijuana farming, and there's before it became legal, and then there's the third of it is about migrant fruit workers, like fruit pickers, and like problems with illegal aliens and that kind of thing. And how it's the economies of these things that he talks about. Similar to how we talked about the economies of Fast Food Nation.
Reefer Madness?
Yes. But I thought the marijuana part was the least interesting part of that book.
Interesting.
That's again another podcast. When we talk about the Mitchell Brothers Behind the Green Door, we're not going to be talking about that. Although there is a movie about the Mitchell Brothers played who are the producers of Behind the Green Door and were owners of a theater in San Francisco, I believe, where they played it and blah, blah, blah. But the two brothers, I think they ended in a murder in real life. The two brothers are played by Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen.
Oh, that's funny.
I think it's called Rated X. And it may have been like an HBO type movie.
That actually, yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. Anyway. So, a movie about brothers. There we go. So, we have maybe the most famous line of this movie is when Johnny is teasing Barbara because she's creeped out by the cemetery. And he says, mm-hmm. in a totally, like, basically it is a... Boris Karloff impression he's doing is they're coming to get you, Barbara. I don't do Boris Karloff very well.
Nicely done. No, yeah. That was good.
But yeah, so he's having fun as this creepy guy, super pale, lurchy kind of guy comes along and stumbles toward them. And so Johnny tells Barbara that, oh yeah, there's one of them. He's coming to get you. And she doesn't think it's funny. They're siblings. She's probably embarrassed about his behavior. He's being a jerk because he's a sibling also. They have actually come to the cemetery, driven like 3 hours to lay down some flowers to their father's grave. But they're doing it because mom's not doing it because mom is, I guess, not able to travel this all this way. So they're just doing it as a chore for mom and they're irritated about it. Or at least Johnny is.
Yeah, I mean, they're being good kids.
Yeah.
But grumbling about it.
As they are, after she's done with her little prayer and they're walking away and they're coming to get you, Barbara, suddenly this guy starts to kind of lurch at Barbara and grabs her. And so Johnny comes to her aid. And there's a brief struggle in which Johnny falls down and slams his head on a grave marker. Presumably killing him. Yeah. Well, I guess it's not presumed because later it turns out he is dead. So, So Barbara jumps in the car. Without the keys, and manages to coast down this road after the zombie, by the way, runs after her and then also picks up a rock as a tool and smashes it at the window.
Yeah, very clever, actually, of her. I don't know that I would have thought about it. When she can't start the car, she realizes she's on a hill and she just puts it in neutral and takes off the emergency brake.
Yeah. Theoretically, she could have, like, popped the clutch and gone if it had been a manual transmission.
Yeah, it surely was too.
Yeah, but she unfortunately hit a tree.
Yeah. Yeah, she was clever, but didn't really capitalize on it.
Yeah. But yeah, all the talk about how Romero zombies are slow as opposed to 28 Days Later zombies. Well, actually zombies run a lot in Romero movies. I mean, they're slow, but when they need to be, they're fast.
Yeah, these aren't the same type of zombies as in Dawn and Day of the Dead, or probably any of the other of the Dead movies.
Yeah, the rules haven't been written. In fact, when the actor S. William Hinsman asked how he was supposed to, he was told how he was supposed to move, like kind of lurching, kind of like as if he was rotting or whatever. He's like, well, but how do I chase after her? And he goes, just figure it out. It's like, okay. So anyway, so blah, blah, blah. She goes, runs away from him. It's just a single attacker at this point and finds this farmhouse and gets into the farmhouse, but discovers it's empty inside, at least of people. And the man appears on the doorstep having followed her, and then suddenly more people are arriving. And she's looking through the house for people or something or a place to hide. And she discovers, again, an iconic scene or a still of that rotten corpse at the top of the stairs.
Yeah, they never really explain that, but is the guess that that was somebody who lived there who was eaten by one of the zombies?
Maybe. Although it's also a question about why that person didn't reanimate.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But... but again, we're not there. We're not thinking about rules of these things. We're just in a old-fashioned horror movie where we don't know what the monster is. And we get a little bit of like radio chatter about how there's some sort of probe to Venus. that returned and yes. knocked out some power. And it was pretty clever how they just kind of glossed over most of it. And you got little pieces of it in the very beginning.
Yeah, there was something coming back from Venus that they blew up in the atmosphere because they were afraid of a virus or bacteria on board. So they blew it up in the atmosphere and spread it all over the Earth.
Yeah, what could go wrong? Anyway, so she's all panicking. By the way, the Barbara is played by Judith O'Day, who has been to a lot of conventions signing autographs and stuff, and you know, good for her. But she, it's not like she did a lot of great acting in this movie. Her role was very, very one note.
Yeah, she spends 80% of the movie catatonic.
Yes. Possibly with a concussion, having been struck in the head by Ben, who we meet in a moment here. Mm-hmm. So, as she's trying to leave the house, but there's a bunch of the ghouls outside, we meet Ben, who he arrives in a pickup, and he goes at these ghouls with a tire iron trying to come inside. And Ben is a well-spoken black man and is ostensibly the lead of this movie, which is, I think, novel for the time.
Yeah, that was a question I had. Was that subversive to have him as the lead of the movie?
Well, they've asked Romero about all of these things, about whether or not the fact that the race element of it was part of it. And I think his answer was, well, they spent a lot of time in that farmhouse at night, like drinking and probably like smoking dope. And he said, we talked about a lot of things. We were college kids, so you could say that all of that was talked about, but it wasn't necessarily supposed to be like the point or anything. In fact, there wasn't any mention of his race in the script. He just happened to be the best actor that auditioned. And they actually, they rewrote his lines to make him sound more academic because in truth, he became a professor.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
I mean, because he not only was the lead and the protagonist, but he was also the most competent of anybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's our hero in the story,
mm-hmm.
which, spoiler, is why it's so tragic at the end.
Yes. It's almost as tragic as the ending of Heat.
So we have basically a siege movie from this point where they're inside this farmhouse and they're trying to figure out what's going on, and Barbara is hysterical, and Ben hits her in the face, knocks her unconscious, or she passes out with shock or whatever.
Well, she hits him, right?
Well, yeah,
because she wants to leave.
Yes,
and go get her brother.
Yeah, and he prevents her because going outside was instant death, or certain death at least. So Ben then finds a rifle and he turns on a radio that he finds and he hears a report about what's going on. And that's when the cellar door opens. And we have two people that come out of the cellar. We have Harry Cooper, played by Carl Hardman, and Tom, played by Keith Wayne. Harry says that he has his wife, Helen, played by Marilyn Eastman, and his daughter, Karen, played by Kyra Schoen, are in the basement as well. And that Karen's been hurt and can't be moved. Tom has a girlfriend named Judith Ridley, also in the cellar.
Yeah, Harry is the worst.
Oh, he's great. He's such a great bad guy.
Yeah, he is the villain of this movie.
First of all, Ben is really angry to find out there are people in the cellar that didn't make themselves known, half an hour ago when they showed up.
Yeah, while he was doing all the work of boarding up the house because Barbara couldn't help because she was concussed.
Yes. And Harry's plot is if they all wait in the cellar till help comes, they'll be fine. And Ben is like, no. If they somehow get into the cellar, there's nowhere to run. You're dead. Better to think of a different way. So blah, 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 blah. Harry's all gloating about how they'd be safer down in the basement. And Helen, who's down in the basement, hears that they have a radio. And so she wants to know the news. So she's like, nope, we're going upstairs, dude.
Yeah, Harry and his wife are not in a happy marriage.
No.
She even says something like, living together isn't much fun, but dying together is going to be even worse. It's like, oh, man. I mean, Harry's a dick, but that was brutal.
Yes. Well, again. So this is where, I mean, then they find a TV, and this is where we get the exposition about how the Venus space probe exploded through its atmosphere, blah, 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 ghouls, blah, 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 gunshot or heavy blow to the head will stop them. And there's been a posse or posses of armed men that are patrolling the countryside to restore order.
It's actually rather hopeful.
That?
Well, it's just, it's not like other zombie movies where just the world's going to crap really quickly. The news they're getting is, this is unprecedented, this is terrible, but, you know, we're getting a handle on it.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they are.
Yeah, and you're right. That's what you want to hear in an emergency. Like, mm-hmm. from an emergency management perspective, they did the right thing. Even though they're just speculating on what's going on, they're making centers for people to come to, they're rescue stations, they've got, I believe the Second Amendment calls it a well-armed militia. and there's, of course, this running scroll on the TV that has all the rescue stations. And Ben notices that there's a town nearby called Willard. And Tom and Judy recognize that since they're from that area. So Ben decides he's going to use his truck, but needs it refueled. So while Harry throws Molotov cocktails out the second floor window at the Walking Dead outside, Ben exits the house armed with a rifle and a flaming torch. And Tom and Judy offer assistance. But when they arrive at the fuel pump near the house, Tom carelessly splashes gasoline on the truck and the torch, starting a grass fire, which quickly spreads to cover the truck. Judy's sleeve is then caught on something inside the truck when it explodes with Tom and Judy inside.
Yeah. So Ben is surely the inspiration for Ash in Evil Dead 2, right?
Sure. Yeah, that seems fair.
Because it's the kind of it's the same kind of thing where he's pretty confident, he's pretty fearless, but shit just keeps going wrong.
And there's not any like comic relief in this movie, really.
I don't know. The truck catching on fire is pretty funny.
So actually, that's not quite true. The townsfolk they interview are hilarious. We'll get to that in a second.
Yes.
So Ben runs back to the house to find that Harry locked him out. So when he finally gets inside, he then punches Harry repeatedly for his cowardice.
Also pretty funny.
Yes. And threatening to throw him out the front door and let the zombies eat him. And as they were watching in horror, some of the living dead begin eating Tom and Judy's charred remains. So then a little bit later, we have another broadcast on the television showing local news reporter Bill Cardile interviewing a local sheriff, George Cassana, about the search and rescue. And here's a little snippet of the things they say to each other.
Hey, Cass, put that thing all the way in the fire. We don't want it getting up again.
All right, I got you.
Chief McClellan, how's everything going?
Oh, things aren't going too bad. Men are taking it pretty good.
You want to get on the other side of the road over there?
Chief, do you think we'll be able to defeat these things?
Well, we killed 19 of them today right in this area. Those last three we caught trying to claw their way into an abandoned shed. They must have thought somebody was in there. There wasn't, though. We heard them making all kind of noise. We came over and beat them off, blasted them down.
Chief, as soon as you're finished, can I see you here?
Yeah, okay.
Chief, if I were surrounded by 6 or 8 of these things, would I stand a chance with them?
Well, there's no problem. If you had a gun, shoot them in the head. That's a sure way to kill them. If you don't, get yourself a club or a torch. Beat them or burn them. They go up pretty easy.
Well, Chief McClellan, how long do you think it will take you until you get the situation under control?
Well, that's pretty hard to say. We don't know how many of them there are. We know when we find them, we can kill them.
Are they slow moving, Chief?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I cannot believe that the racial politics in this movie were just an accident. I mean, they call them posses, right?
Well, that was a thing, though, I think, right?
Well, yeah, it was the thing. And the sheriff is the redneckiest of the rednecks.
Yes.
And
I'm not sure how many. I mean, I don't have as good a feel for the lower 48 as you do, but in the Pennsylvania area, how many rednecks are there? I mean, I know there are hills, so there must be billies.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not all that familiar with the Pennsylvania countryside, but I reckon.
Well, I suppose if the Amish live there, as well as Philadelphia 76ers fans, there's room for everybody, right?
Yes.
Blah, blah, blah. It gets to become nighttime, and the ghouls are starting to break. You try to break into the house, and Ben holds him back, but he drops his rifle, which Harry seizes the rifle and turns it on Ben. And Harry orders his wife to go down to the cellar. And Ben manages to get the rifle away from Harry and then shoots him. And Harry stumbles into the cellar and dies.
He dies next to his daughter.
Yes. Who's not looking so good.
Yeah.
So Karen's also trying to hold on the zombies. But they're overwhelming. So Barbara comes out of her catatonic state and throws herself into the battle too. And then Helen goes back to the cellar, where she discovers that her daughter is now one of the living dead and is consuming her father. And then the daughter comes up and stabs her mother repeatedly with a cement trowel, which is pretty gruesome. I mean, this is, again, this is a gruesome turn. We got father eaten. We got mother stabbing. I mean, this girl ends up on the Group W bench for sure.
Yes, absolutely. So, I don't know. She doesn't eat her mom, though, right?
No, I don't think so.
But there was some nice black and white blood splatter.
Oh, yeah. It
looked great.
Yeah, well, and during the night, there were scenes of the ghouls outside, like, eating human flesh. But turns out those were actually, like, they went to a butcher and got, like, pig entrails and stuff. So I'm sure they didn't make much money, these actors, but they had to cover themselves in, you know, on a rotten meat and chew on it. So, okay, blah, blah, blah. The dead finally break into the house. Barbara sees her brother, Johnny. We know him from his driving gloves. And she just lowers her defenses and gets carried away by the zombie horde. Presumably to be killed, but, you know, that's, I don't think she's going to become their zombie queen.
Well, as they're dragging her off, she maniacally screams, "I can hold my breath for a long time."
Exactly. So then little zombie Karen comes up from the basement and attacks Ben, but he throws her to the side and retreats to the cellar, locking the door behind him, which in this plot synopsis says, which ironically is Harry's plan all along. So Harry's the worst, but it turns out he was right.
Oh, the synopsis author was a Harry fan.
So then Harry and Helen reanimate and she shoots them, and he just has to crouch in the basement with his rifle ready to make his last stand. While the undead walk through the house, as well as pound on the boarded up basement door. But they can't get into the basement. So come the morning, and the mob has left the house and dispersed. And a posse approaches the house and kills the remaining zombies lurking around. Hearing the commotion and gunshots, Ben cautiously goes up the cellar stairs to the living room and peers out the window. At which point he is shot in the head by a posse member who mistakes him for a zombie.
Yes, brutal.
It's, not only is it brutal, but the end credits where they show him, they show like stills of them picking him up with meat hooks and throwing them on the pile of corpses to burn. That is some like Mississippi Burning type shit.
Yeah, it's a really nihilistic ending.
Yeah. The thing about it, like, did you like watching it recently? Or have you watched it recently?
Yeah, I watched it yesterday.
Excellent. And what was the experience like for you?
Watching it on newer technology TVs does not do it any favors.
Sure.
But as far as being a well-made film, it still really holds up. It's really interestingly made. You know, it's black and white, so the color and the lighting is really interesting. It's really stylized. It has like interesting camera angles and stuff. So that really struck me watching it now as an older person. And the story is really simple, but it's really creative. And the ending still gets me because it's a short movie. It moves along really quickly. And even though you know all the tropes, you know, that have since been cliches, probably because of this movie, nothing about this movie is surprising anymore, but it's done so well that it really does hold up.
Yeah, that's how I felt. I mean, at first I was like, in the first opening scene again with "They're coming to get you, Barbara." You know, I just love that because it's so much like 50s and 60s horror movie cliche stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to the house, and again, it's some like, you know, some horror movie cliche stuff. And then it takes that dark turn in the middle and at the very end that is just so again, to me, you know, you like, I don't care about any of the other characters. Well, that's not true. I don't like Harry, so I care about him. I'm not unhappy when Harry dies.
Right.
But, you know, I care about Ben. And so when Ben dies at the end, it's like, oh, so it's, yeah. I don't know. Thank you for letting me talk about it, because I really enjoyed it. I highly recommend it. I'm not sure whether or not it became so popular because it was in the public domain and therefore you could show it on TV or wherever you wanted, anytime you wanted. Theoretically. I don't know how much of that really, like, if they threw out another print that had any additional scenes or something, I think they could have, I don't know, something about that. But it certainly is easy to find. You'll find it on every like 100 horror movies on 6 DVDs set or whatever.
I'm pretty sure I watched, I think in this, on the same night, you and I watched Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead.
Yes.
And I saw those way before I ever saw Night of the Living Dead. So my introduction to zombie movies were those two. Those two Romero movies.
And those are different.
Very different. Very different.
And those are super political. Mm-hmm. And super gory, frankly.
Yeah. And Day of the Dead is pretty cheesy, but I loved it, and I still have a very nostalgic feeling for it. But yeah, Dawn of the Dead is great.
Yeah. I think I mentioned before that I have sort of a love-hate relationship with Dawn of the Dead, because I, you know, there's so much about it that I love, but yeah, a high def watching of that movie doesn't no service either, because you realize the zombies are just people with blue paint on them.
Right.
And there's, so that doesn't work really at its advantage. And the gore, what they do is great. I mean, I think it's all Tom Savini, but it's fantastic and kind of revolutionary too. And I, you know, Day has always been like, again, it's a little cheesier. Mm-hmm. Although I think it goes in a really interesting direction, because just Dawn is way, it's this little siege thing, but it's way out in the open. And by the time you get to Day, it's kind of like the I Am Legend thing, where there's not a lot of people left. You don't think,
right? Yeah, it builds out the world.
Yeah,
while still being like really contained.
Exactly. So at some point we will have to talk about those movies too. But like Bub, like I never liked Bub. The zombie that salutes at the end of Day.
Yeah.
But I get it. I mean, I understand the horse science fiction element, the mad scientist doctor, whatever. And God knows that would happen.
Yeah, and there was a nod to that in 28 Days Later, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that persevered in popular culture.
Yeah. Well, you know, where there are things. Did you hear about the Brazilian genetically modified mosquitoes?
No.
Well, after...
Sounds fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, after, you know, when the Zika virus was a big deal during the Olympics and stuff, they thought, well, how best to squash the population of mosquitoes without ruining the ecosystem? Well, let's just bioengineer some mosquitoes that I guess don't reproduce or something. So you'll preserve the genetics of the mosquitoes in the ecosystem. You won't contaminate them with some foreign mosquitoes like Africanized bees or whatever. Well, apparently it has not worked out well. And, you know, we don't actually know quite yet the consequences of it, but it's sort of like a, I don't know, Jurassic Park sort of thing.
Haven't they seen Jurassic Park? Yeah. Nature finds a way.
Yeah. So we'll see. Yeah, what could go wrong? Yeah, between that and, you know, nuclear accidents in Russia that are still not really being talked about, and the fact that they have all those holding tanks for the water, the contaminated water in Fukushima, and by 2020 they'll be out of room in those tanks, and they're going to release it into the ocean.
Why not?
Like, they built these big ice walls to prevent it from going through the groundwater. Initially, while they try to pump the stuff out of there. But yeah, they're like, well, at a certain point, sorry guys, we're going to have to dump all this into the ocean. So the bonus is sushi will glow in the dark.
Yeah, that's not how radiation works.
Okay, sorry, sushi will have big tumors in it.
I did enjoy that text we got from Jason about the Chernobyl viewer from Pripyat.
Oh, yes.
As a resident of Pripyat, I watched Chernobyl, and I was able to count at least 17 inaccuracies on my right hand alone.
Yeah. Pretty funny. But less funny when you have to point out that that's not how radiation works. Oh, well. Go to school for something, and all of a sudden you take it seriously. So, any other thoughts on Night of the Living Dead?
No, check it out. It's worth it.
Yeah, it's just fun. And the scenes that are cheesy, it's 1968 movie, so it lives in the cheese.
And it's barely over an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
So then we get to the second movie. This one's your pick. Mm-hmm. Revenge, 2017, written and directed by Coralie Fargier. I don't know. She's French. There's a lot of French actors in this movie.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear what you thought of it.
Well, okay, so you introduced us to it. When did you first see it? What did you think?
I don't remember where I first heard about it, but it got on my radar sometime a couple years ago, and I noticed that it was on Shudder. So I threw it on and watched it and was pleasantly surprised. And it reminded me of a lot of those exploitation slasher revenge movies that we watched when we were much, much younger.
Yes.
But this one had a slightly different perspective on it. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a weird one for me. Mm-hmm. I watched it for the first time 2 nights ago and I liked it. But I don't think I liked it as much as you. So I'm interested to see what the spark was for you. But I'm not sure what this, especially with the end, I'm not sure what this movie is trying to tell us. But I thought the visuals, see, this is another thing where I think this movie is probably shot in digital, right? Because it's really crisp and stuff. There's a lot of blood at the end. I mean, there's blood throughout, but there's a lot of blood on white walls.
It's very bright.
Yeah, but it's beautifully done. It looks great. But there's a scene where a guy gets a knife stabbed in his eye, which doesn't hold up as well, I don't think. It's not as good an effect. It's fine, I suppose. But, you know, I don't know what I would be expecting otherwise. But it just looked super fake. Then again, I've never seen anybody stabbed in the eye with a hunting knife, so who knows?
Right.
Also, do they ever point out where this movie takes place?
I think they mentioned it in the beginning.
Maybe. Okay. Because I had forgotten it. So I was trying to think, you know, they're in the desert someplace. But for some reason, I thought they were in Australia. But turns out they were in Morocco.
Yeah. I was going to say like North Africa or very, very Southern Europe, right?
Yeah. They're French. So it seems about right. And as far as I could tell, this director hasn't done anything else in America, right?
Not that I know of.
I mean, she wrote it and directed it, but I haven't really heard much about her. The fact that she's a female director and writer of this movie maybe legitimizes some of the things in this movie. I'm not sure. And when I was watching this movie, I instantly thought, okay, this is just I Spit on Your Grave, right?
Right. Yeah, that's immediately where my mind went to. Yeah.
Which I think is what they're supposed to be like. So we start out with Jen, played by Matilda Lutz. We know her from Rings, if you saw Rings. The worst of the Ring movies. But it has Johnny Galecki, so what do you do? She is described in this, again, plot synopsis from IMDb. She's described as an American socialite who is in a secret relationship with French millionaire Richard, played by Kevin Janssens.
American socialite?
Yeah, see, I didn't see her as American socialite as much as maybe prostitute.
she was just a mistress.
Yeah, I think maybe she's like a yacht girl or something.
Yeah.
So they're at this luxury house at the top of a hill in the deserts of Morocco, accessed primarily by helicopter, or at least sometimes by helicopter. I guess you can drive. But as they are landing in the helicopter pilot gives Richard some peyote as a gift and to use it with his girlfriend or whatever. And this, to me, it starts out, seems very much like an Eli Roth type movie. Or like something he would be involved in. This has a very Avalanche, Aftershock. Have you seen the movie Aftershock?
I have not.
The movie Aftershock is worth seeing. Eli Roth actually is in it, and he produces it, but he's not the director of it. It's directed by maybe a Chilean director. But this movie has that feel to it. And also The Green Inferno, also an Eli Roth movie, kind of his take on Cannibal Holocaust.
I have seen that one.
Yeah. Do you see where these... Maybe just because it's very crisp.
Yeah, it's very bright. It has like a very disarming setup to it.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's just this couple. He's really rich. She's very young and sexually free. So you can see the match.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little ditzy.
Yeah, and they're in this amazing house / hunting lodge, and they are obviously in the early stages of a relationship.
Yes,
where they're still like very lovey, very handsy. It's all about the enjoying time with each other and having lots of sex.
Yes, because they are also two beautiful people.
Yes.
They're both very fit, and she is very young, and he is youngish, I suppose. Although we find out quickly that she's the mistress because he keeps calling home to talk to his wife.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but this actor has like 2% body fat.
Maybe. Yeah, there's a lot of this actor being nude in this movie, which, I'm sure he's fine with because, yeah, if I look like that, maybe I'd be fine with it too.
Yeah, I don't know why that guy would ever wear a shirt.
Exactly. Yeah. Or pants, really.
Fair enough.
I'm trying to think. Jason, this might be a movie to watch, if only for that, because I don't think there's any animals hurt in this movie. Can't think of any.
No?
Yeah.
No.
Anyway, okay.
So, some ants.
Yeah, well, yeah. Those fuckers had it coming.
They really did.
Have you seen Phase 4?
No.
Phase 4 is a horror movie where the ants are the zombie horde, and it's real ants, and it's really, and it's not like big, huge ants, it's just regular little ants, but it's shot in such a way as the ants look so menacing, and like a colony of ants looks so menacing. It's great. Anyway.
My daughters still love watching Naked and Afraid, and I will second that emotion. A colony of ants looks terrifying.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I'm sure.
Because they're fast, too.
And they glisten. I hate that word. Okay, so. So we have this, like, a hunting lodge thing in the desert.
They'll build bridges using themselves.
Yes. Yeah, like hive mind and stuff. It's crazy. Yeah. Kind of like in World War Z, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, we have Jen and Richard, again, who are... all these people are rich and sexy and whatever, but they are interrupted by two weirdo hunting guys named Stan and Dimitri. And it turns out they are actually, Richard is there on a hunting trip. Mm-hmm. And Jen is supposed to leave like the next day, which is the day these guys are supposed to arrive, but they get there early. So Richard has to share time with Jen. With these guys, who he's none too happy about.
And they're immediately creepy.
Yeah. And we have a night of drinking and dancing and whatever, just like all the four of them. And they find out about the peyote, and Richard's like, nope, you guys are going to take this stuff. So he tells Jen to hide it someplace safe. So she puts it in a locket around her neck. I was not sure how she was going to get this like plastic envelope into this locket, but she seemed to do okay.
She'd done it before, for sure.
Yeah. So the next morning, Richard's away, and Stan, Mr. Creepy Guy, who really does a good job as Mr. Creepy Guy.
Yes.
Actually, I think all the acting in this movie is pretty good, except for Jen. I don't quite get it. I mean, she acts appropriately emotional, but I guess because she doesn't have a lot of lines in the movie, really. I don't know.
Oh, I thought she was great.
Yeah. So Stan tries to get Jen to have sex with him, and she refuses, so he rapes her. And Dimitri, like, interrupts them pre-rape and has an opportunity to stop it, theoretically. But he doesn't. He just goes back and turns the TV up louder. So, you know, that's, of course, ugly and horrible. And then Richard returns, and you think Richard would be really upset with Stan. And so he is. And Richard offers her a large sum of money to forget about the whole thing. And Jen's like, yeah. No, call the helicopter, I'm leaving. So during this whole thing, we learn out that Richard is a really bad guy as well. Because...
I think he hits her at this point,
he
right?
does, yes. Yeah, and says, who do you think I am? Or, sorry, who do you think you are? So she then ends up running off to the desert, and the three men give chase. And they end up at this cliff. By the way, if you haven't seen the movie, now's the time to stop listening to this program and skip to housekeeping. Because this is where the spoilers start to happen big time.
Yeah, and were there any surprises in this movie for you that, like, actually got you?
As far as, well, I didn't expect her to land on the tree.
Yep, that was one.
Yeah, I thought that Stan, Mr. Creepy, Stan's character, I thought was well written in the fact that he knows he did a bad, bad thing. He doesn't like, he didn't intend to kill anybody.
Right.
And he is not happy about the whole thing. So that was, I thought that was a nice, not really a turn, but a nice character choice for him. And I don't quite know how she used the fire to get out of the tree. That's.
Yeah. But she did.
But she did. Yeah. So she gets to, basically they chase her to the cliff, and Richard tries to talk her out of her figurative tree and finally convinces her that he's called the helicopter. And so everybody's going to be fine. So he turns to go back to the house with her. And because everybody's now, you've stopped holding your breath. And then he turns back and pushes her off the cliff. And she goes down the cliff and lands back first on a tree that impales her.
Yes, very gruesome.
Yes, through the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, Dimitri and Stan realize, oh yeah, Richard is a really bad guy. Because he's like, yeah, we're going to still do our hunting trip. We'll take care of this along the way. It seems like maybe Richard has a binder of this hunting trip, and he's not going to deviate from that binder no matter what bump comes in the road.
Yeah, that's what a bad guy Richard is. The rapist is looking at him like, what are you doing?
Exactly. So this is, again, Jen is, face up, bent backward with a tree impaling her in the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ants both at the base of the tree and on top of the on the stick protruding from the front of her abdomen. And because she is bent in that way, she can't really get off of it on her own, it seems.
Right. I mean, she has no leverage.
Yeah, and she is unconscious for an unknown amount of time, but enough to have a bunch of blood comes out. So she manages to, just barely using using her headphones, I think, to grab a lighter that had fallen with her. And she then starts a fire at the base of the tree, which I guess causes it to weaken and break, and so she could roll off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. That was the part that was like, oh, that's weird. But I don't know, maybe another third of this movie, she walks around with the parrot with the stick going through her body.
Yeah.
Now we have the next day, they look down and they see that she is gone, or she's not there at the base, or maybe later the same day. This is later the same day, right?
Yeah, they're going to go back and retrieve the body, right?
Yeah. And she is not there, so they're like, oh crap, we better do this now. So they get in their rigs, which consist of a motorcycle, a four-wheeled ATV, and then a Jeep of some kind.
Mm-hmm. And she is just narrowly staying out of view of them. So it's a sort of immediate cat and mouse game.
Yeah. And she is severely disadvantaged being impaled and leaking blood. She's not a hunter. These guys are hunters, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this has turned into a kind of a most dangerous game, although unintentionally. Maybe right. For Richard it has been, but yeah. So she manages to get to a river And that's where they lose her.
By the way, my touchstone for this kind of thing is really surviving the game.
Surviving? Is that with Ice-T?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
And Rucker Hauer. And yes. John T. McGinley. Charles S. Dutton.
Well, it's our generation's The Most Dangerous Game.
Yeah.
So, the posse. No, it's not really. But three people does not make a posse. They manage to track her blood to the little river, little stream. So they decide, okay, Richard's going to go one way, Dimitri's going to go the other way, and Stan's going to sit in a damn car. Or maybe Stan actually weenies his way into not having to go with them and waits for the car. Either way. So we have Dimitri, who is he's seemingly a bumbling guy, right? The fat guy. Mm-hmm. So he's like, you know, he's like comic relief, kind of dumb. The one guy's raping, he's just eating Cheetos or whatever.
Nursing his hangover.
Yeah. So he is urinating by his ATV where his gun is set up against a rock behind him, too far for him to reach in a hurry. She sees this and bolts for the gun, gets the gun, and pulls the trigger on Dimitri. Was this the other part that shocked you?
Yeah, Dimitri took a real turn here.
Yeah. Dimitri is the type of hunter, he tells her, that he lets the prey come to him. He think that he makes them think that they are hunting him, and he wasn't going to put actual shells in his gun, so he's going to do it more personal, and so he's going to drown her. And it's all very the makeup in this movie, like it's fairly what's the right way to describe it? She's pretty messed up from this whole landing on a tree thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I mean, she's continues to be all messed up through the movie.
Yeah.
Like there's the very final image, it makes it sort of look like she's a superhero, but she's still all messed up.
Yeah. Yeah. They really commit to the bit, you could say.
Yeah.
With the gore and the blood. But this is one of those moments when I knew the movie was working for me because, as implausible as this fight was, I realized that Dimitri, he's this dude who's friends with a racist and a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed a rape to happen even after she asked him for help. And still, when it turned out he was more of a bad guy than I had expected, I was really disappointed in him.
Exactly.
I was like, oh man. Even with all that, I was still bummed out. And, you know, he certainly got what he deserved.
Yes, which was a hunting knife in the eye. And then we have what I like to call a trip to Peyote Junction.
Yeah, she goes and finds a cave to convalesce in.
And that's where she takes the peyote, and we see in great detail, it's a Father Anderson movie for sure, she has to remove the piece of wood or whatever that's impaling her, cauterize the wound. It's all super gruesome. But it ends up having like giving her a makeshift tattoo.
Yeah, because she used a beer can that she heated up in the fire to cauterize the hole. And it had like this weird kind of phoenix pattern on it. A little on the nose, but yeah, it gave her like this badass brand on her stomach.
And then we get the recurrent nightmares, which is, we have some really gruesome head exploding in the nightmares that doesn't appear elsewhere.
No.
Yeah. So then the next day, Richard and Stan find Dimitri's body in a, I guess, sort of like a comic way, I guess.
Yeah, because Stan was relieving himself in the river, right?
Yeah.
And Dimitri floats up out of nowhere, looking all bloated and stabby.
Yes. So Richard then, of course, now Stan is, again, his chicken has already flipped once. It flips yet again. And Richard's like, oh no, we're going to find this woman. Although he probably doesn't think of her as a person. by that, of course, because she killed Dimitri, Jen has Dimitri's SUV, drives it as far as the gas will get her. So then we have Richard tracking, Stan tracking her down, finding her, and we have this fairly long gunfight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she continues to get injured. I mean, everybody gets injured, but she's the one that doesn't die.
He has that really gruesome foot foot injury. Oh, my God.
And what was that lingering over taking the glass out of the foot? That was especially Father Anderson.
Well, that was a commentary on the rape, right?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because of the shape of the wound?
Okay.
You didn't see that?
No.
Oh. Go back and watch it again.
Okay. Here, tangent time. Have you seen, there's a, I think it's called Creative Chefs or something, but it was a recipe, one of those video recipes for chicken cordon bleu, and Kelly posted it on Facebook with my name on it to look at it. And, you know, since she's been home while she's at school, she'll, you know, try out new dishes to make stuff. Mm-hmm. So I just assumed she was like, hey, do you want me to try making this? So because it's chicken cordon bleu and I'm not a fan of that, I just didn't even look at the video. She's like, oh no, you have to look at the video. Like, why? She goes, you have to look at the video. It's the most sexual thing you have ever seen. Because they take these chicken breasts and like slice them open, and it is like, yeah, that actually, and it's supposed to holds it open with his fingers and stuff. Oh my God. It's like, it is pornographic. In a way that I did not see in this movie about Stan's foot. But maybe so. Yeah. You're probably right. I mean, but they lingered for a long time.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a very specific shape.
Yes. Oh, by the way, during this gunfight, Jen gets her earlobe blown off. Then we have Stan. Jen thinks she's, you know, we think Jen's gotten away from Stan, but Stan gets a piece of glass out of his foot, gets back in the car, and he is going to run her down. However, he's unsuccessful. Because this movie
it does not
called,
go well.
Yeah, the movie is not called Dead Girl. The movie's called Revenge. So, you know, I think we know how this is going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have Jen has taken out Dimitri and Stan. There's only Richard left. So Richard returns home and he is all bloody and messed up from the night before. And everything in this house is all based on like white and beige. So, like, he sits down on the white couch, and he's got, like, the bloody gun and stuff, and it's like, oh, you're gonna lose your deposit, dude. For sure.
I thought he owned it.
No, maybe he does. I don't know. But either way, he's, you're probably right, if he's supposed to be a multimillionaire. So, another nude shot, he takes a shower.
Yeah, it really lingers on him when he's nude, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now we have the final cat and mouse game. And luckily, the hunting lodge is a perfect maze because they keep going around these little corridors and hallways and outdoors and outside and back in other doors. And there's a lot of probably like GoPro type cameras at the end of guns.
I loved this sequence. I loved it. This is what turned the movie up to 11 for me. There was so much color. There was so much blood. There were so many long tracking shots. And it's a really simple chase between two people in a rather confined area, but I found it really compelling. I found it full of tension. I found the little bits of it very clever.
Oh, yeah. It's great. And Richard, the actor, does a great job because Richard is full of emotion and Jen yeah. is not,
mm-hmm.
you know, Jen is numb or whatever. And maybe that's why I don't credit her as much with giving as good a performance, because Richard is so expressive when he turns it on, and she doesn't, she's just surviving. So there's not like an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, she was in Terminator mode, but at the end, you know, after he hits her with the shotgun and then starts dragging her across the floor. I mean, she loses her shit at that point. I mean, she is not calm in that moment.
Oh yeah, no, the whole thing is great, and yeah, it's easy to yada yada. It's essentially a 2-person foot chase, 2 people with long guns.
One of whom is spewing blood.
Yeah, and completely naked.
Cartoonish amounts of blood.
Yes. Yeah. So now, at the end, she finally kills him. I mean, and it's yada yadaing, really good action scene. Really, like I said, super colorfully bloody. I mean, I admire the artistry of this kind of movie. It's not it's not like Martyrs where it's intended, I think, to gross you out.
All right.
I think this is gross, but it's intended to paint a picture.
Yes.
Yeah. So I thought it was really well done. But at the end, by the way, why does everybody walk out on this ledge by the infinity pool that he has?
That's why you have an infinity pool, because it looks cool to do that.
I guess. But anyway, so at the very end, I guess the chopper's coming.
Mm-hmm.
Which presumably she knows about.
Yeah.
And she walks to the end of the infinity pool thing, and then turns and looks in the camera and freeze frame. So yeah. What does that mean? Doesn't she mean we're going to have Revenge 2, where she takes out the helicopter pilot? And then goes after Richard's...
No, what? She survived. She got revenge, and now she's getting out of there.
So yeah, so this is actually just a straight-up grindhouse exploitation movie, right?
Sort of. I mean, that was another thing I appreciated about it. There's not a lot of exploitation in it, though. It's set up like an exploitation movie, but in those movies, like I Spit on Your Grave, you know, the triggering trauma is like the movie tends to linger on that in exploitation movies, right?
Yeah.
In this movie, it doesn't really linger on. It kind of cuts away. You hear it, you don't really see it, and then you see the aftermath of it. So that was different. So I think when you linger on those moments, it tends to diminish that character.
Sure. Is she ever naked in this movie?
Yes, but I think only like when she's changing clothes.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, it's true. Like, she's topless.
Not during a sex scene or the rape scene or anything.
Yeah. Okay, you're right. You're right.
So, yeah, it's structured like an exploitation movie, but it's not exploitative of her. So I thought that was interesting. And yeah, there's certainly more male nudity than female nudity in this movie.
Oh, for sure.
Which was fun at the end, just because the way that scene is shot. Because with him being nude and getting like a gut shot from a shotgun, just gives so much opportunity for so much blood.
Oh.
And to spray everywhere. So... that I thought was different than a movie like I Spit on Your Grave, but also it was so bright. Like,
yes.
Those 70s exploitation movies. I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but they always tended to be kind of dark and dimly lit and take place at night. This was so bright. It was mostly in the day, except for the weird peyote scene.
So is this what they talk about, the recent daytime horror movies? Like, I think they said Midsummer was like that.
I didn't know. Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, I think it's a thing.
It feels like it.
Yeah.
And because it was so bright, that I think color really played a prominent role in this movie. And it looked, I mean, yeah, I'll use it. It looked beautiful. I mean, though it was gruesome, it was a beautifully shot movie. The landscapes are beautiful. The blood and the viscera was really colorful, and it, like you said, it really did make those scenes like a painting.
You're absolutely right. The director had color on the brain when she was doing this. I mean, this was intentionally you could probably go through and like pick out the different things. So like all of Jen's clothes early on are like white and pink, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like everything she has is pink until the event, and then everything she basically has is like black and brown.
Yeah, and there's a lot of imagery in this movie. Some of it's really obvious and on the nose, like the rotting apple.
Yeah, the painting on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Some of it's a little bit more subtle, like the vagina shaped wound on Stan's foot.
So subtle, I didn't think.
If you go back and watch it, there's no way that's not what the intent of that.
Okay,
that's the whole reason they lingered on him having to painfully extract something from that wound.
If you go to if you log on to your Facebook, I will post something on a creepy way thing that shows the chicken cordon bleu.
Okay,
because it is really wrong.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, and it's wrong in a way that seems like it. The best part of it is the comments, because people are like, who doesn't season their chicken? Like, they put it in the oven for 30 minutes and there's raw potatoes in there. They're not going to be done. Yeah, that's not what it's all about, dude.
Oh, they're so earnest.
But I can't tell whether it's on purpose or not, except that once you see it, you think, oh, you can't unsee it. So yeah, so revenge. So thank you for making. I mean, it's been on my radar, so it was nice to watch it. But yeah, I guess I wasn't sure how I felt at the end. I mean, I guess we felt triumphant because she won, but she was still pretty profoundly wounded.
Oh yeah, I mean, well yeah, her life is fucked. I mean,
yeah,
that guy, those guys destroyed her life.
Yes.
And she got revenge by killing them, but
that doesn't improve her life.
Yeah, that's also a commentary on revenge, right?
Yeah, there you go.
It doesn't necessarily make everything better.
Tell them.
It probably feels good in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. There you go. That's way deeper than I was thinking when I was watching this movie.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast. We're going to leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast. We're going to leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's a brother Sanderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Aaron, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.
Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Aaron.